a quick thank you to everyone who signed up as financial supporters via Patreon. If you want to continue hearing this content, please sign up for only $4, £3 or €3 a month. Check out the various options at coldwarconversations.com/donate. Now on with this week's episode.
And then there was this kind of very tense moment where the damaged Warspite and the damaged Russian Echo 2 were both on the surface looking at each other, inspecting each other through periscopes and wondering what was next.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Today we speak with Ian Ballantyne, the author of Hunter Killers, also known as Undersea Warriors in the United States. Hunter Killers tells the incredible true inside story of the Royal Navy's Cold War beneath the waves. Ian and I talk about the forgotten role Royal Navy submarines played in the Cuban Missile Crisis, whilst also hearing the truth behind what official statements called collisions with icebergs. We also cover the processes and procedures of the Polaris nuclear missile submarines, including the letters of last resort. Now, I could really do with some help to allow me more time to continue producing and preserving these Cold War stories. A monthly donation to help keep us on the air is only about $3, £3 or €3 a month, although larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you can get this sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a monthly financial supporter, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If a financial contribution is not your cup of tea, then you can still help us by leaving written reviews wherever you listen to us, as well as sharing us on social media. It really helps us get new guests on the show. I'd like to thank some of our recent reviewers on Apple Podcasts, particularly Kevin B., Neil Greggs and Sergeant Ellis for their 5-star reviews. Thank you so much. So, back to today's episode. I'm delighted to welcome Ian Ballantyne to our Cold War conversation.
There were lots of boats that were, I would say, built towards the end of the Second World War that they tried to squeeze more life out of. And then as the post-Cold War era dawned, the Royal Navy was fairly strapped for resources, so they persisted with them and decided they would build on some of the advances in technology that had been achieved by the Germans with their revolutionary U-boats, like the Type 21, at the end of the Second World War.
Right. And the Soviets, did they have access to some of that Nazi technology as well?
Yeah, generally what happened was at the end of the war, the booty, should we say, the submarine booty that was found in various harbours or submarine construction yards was divided up between the victorious Allies. So the Russians got some, the Americans got some, the British got some, the French and one or two other nations that were interested were also able to tap into this technology. So they were each given a share of the most advanced vessels, which included the Type 21 U-boat. And although the Type 21 had only managed to complete 2 combat deployments in the war and was far from perfect, it did incorporate a lot of cutting-edge tech that the Allies, who soon became less than allies after the Second World War, decided they would capitalise on.
Right, because the Soviets weren't really known for their submarines, were they, in World War II?
No, I mean, there's a long history of creating submarines in Russia, just as there was in America, in Britain and various other nations. But in terms of the way in which the Russian Navy, the Red Navy, was used in the Second World War. It wasn't really like the Americans, the Japanese, the Germans, or the British, in that it stuck fairly close to Russian shores and was seen as a supporting arm for the Red Army, for the Russian Army. And it did send out submarines in the Baltic and also up north in the Arctic from Murmansk. But it is true to say they did not operate in quite the same adventurous way that the other nations during the Second World War did.
So as we move into the 1950s, one of the things I did want to underline is this book is packed full of great stories and incidents, many of which I'd never heard of, some of which I'd heard a little bit about. But Ian really does provide a lot of detail on these. And there were a couple of incidents in the 1950s, one of which is quite an echo to the Kursk submarine accident, which I think was in the, was that the 1990s?
The year 2000, the Russian Oscar-class submarine Kursk had an incident whilst in the Barents Sea. It is thought that a weapon that used a very unstable propellant called high-test peroxide exploded, and that basically destroyed the submarine, sent it to the bottom of the sea, with a few of her crew trapped for a while, but they eventually expired. So it's a very famous incident from August 2000. And I think what you're referring to is HMS Sidon, which was in port at Portland. And what happened there was the British were experimenting with high-test peroxide-propelled torpedoes. And as one of those weapons was being slid into a tube, it accidentally went past what's called the top stop, and the engine was started while it was in the tube, and the fuel ignited. This created an explosion that killed people in the forward areas of the submarine, and in harbour, she basically came to grief. And they were lucky in some ways in that people that were not in that forward part of the submarine were able to jump overboard and escape this inferno of flames and fumes. It was very similar in some ways to the incident with the Kursk, in that a weapon with an unstable propellant exploded. So there was a precursor there. And I think the Western navies realised that HTP, propelling torpedoes, or in fact submarines, was a very unwise idea. And so they gave up that proposal, but the Russians persisted with it because they wanted high speed for their weapons.
Yeah, surprising they were still using that dangerous propellant even at that time.
There were other contributory factors, but that was a key part of it with the Kursk.
Yeah. Yeah, and the following year, there's an incident at Gosport with a Soviet cruiser and a certain Commander Crab. Can you just describe that to our listeners?
What happened on that occasion was Commander Crab, who was a very famous Second World War frogman who'd been up to all sorts of amazing exploits in waters off Gibraltar against the Italians who were trying to infiltrate that harbour and sink Allied ships. Post-war was engaged in exploits that included going underneath Russian cruisers. And he'd actually done it before. And the idea was that he'd go underneath and find out what new tech was underneath the waterline. So when this Russian cruiser came to Portsmouth carrying Khrushchev, he was sent on a kind of a rogue mission to see what he could find, and somehow disappeared. Ended up dead and was found in Chichester Harbour with no head and no hands. And nobody really knows what happened to him, but the speculation is that he was caught by the Russians carrying out this inspection in Portsmouth Harbour and then was killed. And it was a very, very embarrassing incident, of course, and had quite big ramifications for intelligence gathering operations by the Royal Navy in the Arctic, off the Kola Peninsula, where the main Russian fleet was based, because those were postponed due to the furore that was created by Crabbe's little exploit.
But the following year, Harold Macmillan succeeds Anthony Eden as Prime Minister, and Macmillan authorised deployments into the Barents Sea, which is the Soviet submarine's real home territory, isn't it?
Yeah, he was told by some of the naval experts that if he didn't resume these pretty risky missions with what were in essence modernized Royal Navy submarines that were using some of the technology from the German Type 21 U-boats, such as high-speed batteries and also a thing called a snorkel, which enables a boat to recharge the batteries, expel fumes, draw in air while submerged, those sort of tweaks, plus intelligence gathering communications equipment put into these old submarines that made them into a thing called a Super T boat. If McMillan was told, if you don't send Super T boats back up into the Barents to do intelligence gathering, the Americans basically will take a dim view of the UK, and it's a major element of the special relationship is to send these specialist submarines that have been converted for this dedicated intelligence gathering mission. So he resumed them, and they were amazing feats of endurance and very, very risky.
Yeah, that really does come across in the book. Can you describe some of those early missions?
Yeah, we're talking about the late 50s and into the early 60s, and one boat that I feature is HMS Taciturn, which was sent up there under the sea for quite a long time. I mean, we're talking about weeks and weeks without actually seeing the outside world. And their main job was to loiter off the coast of the Soviet Union and stay hidden and dodge any Russian helicopters or other surface ships or even other submarines, and basically spy on anything the Russians were up to on their firing ranges, or pick up the new radar signals or even the propeller characteristics of Russian vessels, so that they could build up an intelligence picture of what new weapons the Russians are developing and also what tech they might have. And they were highly secret, and the submariners that were engaged in them were told not to tell their families anything about them. And before they left, they weren't allowed to phone home. They had to leave a letter in which they mustn't mention the mission, and that would be posted after they'd gone. And then some weeks later, they would sort of reappear and nobody would know where they'd been. But they could risk all sorts of retaliation by the Russians if caught, such as depth charging in one instance with a submarine called Turpin, actually having a torpedo fired and being trapped by a mine in a minefield and suffering damage actually during the depth charging. So they were risky things. And the conditions that the submariners endured were, we've seen the film Das Boot. I mean, it was like Das Boot. It was pretty horrible conditions, with shortage of water, not being able to wash, sometimes lacking air. I mean, everything you think of in a traditional kind of U-boat film like Das Boot, these British submariners had to endure for weeks at a time in secret in the late 50s and early 60s.
Yes, you tell quite a graphic tale of Turpin and the depth charges and the minefield. I mean, risky sounds like an understatement. This sounds like really dangerous missions. And I was struck by the commander of Taciturn. I think he tells his crew this is going to be like a wartime patrol.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about these guys that were submarine captains at that time in the Royal Navy was they had actually served in the Second World War. So they were that bit older than their ratings and their junior officers. So they knew the risks that they were going to face. So the conditions that they went into were, if they'd been in submarines, were very familiar to them. And also, these submarines carried what was really a warload of torpedoes. So they were fully ready to defend themselves if they were cornered, and they hoped that they wouldn't. So you're right. Lieutenant Commander O'Connor basically said, this is what we're going to do, and you better get yourselves in the right mindset, because this is going to be a mission in which we're going to spend up to 7 weeks away, and we'll be dived most of the time, and we will face probably retaliation if we're caught. And they actually had on board a Russian-speaking officer that worked with the technicians, the intelligence-gathering technicians, who were also put on board the submarine to listen in on Soviet wireless transmissions to try and pick up what was going on. So it was real secret stuff that they were up to.
Incredible. And among the many stories that I wasn't aware of was the Royal Navy's participation in the Cuba quarantine during the Cuba Missile Crisis of 1960. Can you just give me a bit of detail on that?
The thing that people don't know or they forget about the Cuban crisis is that obviously the main line of confrontation was at sea and with the President Kennedy's quarantine of Cuba. But beyond that, further north in the Atlantic, there were actually Canadian surface warships. Even HMS Belfast was sent down potentially to get involved. But most of all, for my book, there was actually two Canadian-based British submarines deployed under the sea in the North Atlantic to try and find Russian submarines going south to trail them and, if needed, get in a position to fire torpedoes. And also, there was at least one submarine deployed from the UK with, again, a warload of torpedoes to go off and try and find out where the Russians were and what they were up to. And those people were fully aware that the crisis could change at any moment into an actual war. And in one submarine based in Canada, HMS Astute, the crew was mixed, Royal Navy and Canadian, because the Canadians didn't operate submarines at that time. So the Royal Navy kind of ran their submarine squadron, the 6th Submarine Squadron, and the Canadians got their submarine experience before they had their own submarines later in the 60s. They were serving in the British ones. And when they were at sea, there was a slight problem in that although Britain was firmly up for the idea of standing shoulder to shoulder with the Americans in a war, if that happened during the crisis, the Canadian government wasn't so sure it wanted to go to war. It was fine with Cold War missions and NATO, but it wasn't sure that it wanted to actually go to war. So these Canadians in the British submarine were told by their naval boss, the Canadian naval boss, that should it come to war, they would not be able to get them off the submarine because, you know, to service a submarine to get rid of the Canadians would potentially expose it to being sunk. So they would stay with this British submarine, HMS Astute, and they should cut off the Canada flash from their uniforms. So if their bodies were found, if they were killed and the bodies were recovered, that it would not be known that Canadians had been in the British submarine during the war. And although, of course, if things had gone badly during the Cuban Missile Crisis, it probably would have been the least of our problems because it could have gone to a nuclear exchange.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's really interesting that. There were also some missions under the polar ice, which are almost reminiscent of the Alastair MacLean book, Ice Station Zebra, and the film.
Yeah, yeah, I know what you're on about. They're in fact, more dangerous than Ice Station Zebra because, of course, that submarine is a nuclear-powered submarine. But during the early 60s, the British had not yet gone down the nuclear-powered submarine path, so they still used these upgraded World War II boats to go under the ice. And the reason they did that in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in particular was to go in there for the first generation Soviet nuclear missile submarines, which it was reckoned would go under the ice there and try and hide and slip by defenses and wait for the order to fire their nuclear missiles, because their range, the early Soviet nuclear missile submarines, the range of their weapons was 200 or 300 miles. So they had to get close to the United States, and they would go under the ice in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. So the British were tasked, at a time when the Americans and Soviets were moving into nuclear power, with sending diesel submarines under the ice. And that was very, very tricky, because if you run out of air, you run out of battery charge when you're submerged under ice, then you cannot potentially get up to surface through a polynya, which is a sort of a hole in the ice, but probably covered in thin, slushy ice, and then surface, open the hatch, and pull in fresh air and get rid of fumes while you charge your battery. So all the time, the Royal Navy submarines that went in under the ice were dicing with death, because if they couldn't, in an emergency, get up there and through the ice, then everybody would die. And so it was actually a very, very, very dangerous thing to do. But they did it, and it actually persuaded the Royal Navy that actually probably ought to get into nuclear power.
Yeah, and this is echoed throughout the book, the incredible bravery of the sailors who were on these boats, particularly with the early technology they were using, but also later on in the Cold War with some of the incidents that you describe in the book as well, which we'll come on to. That one of the many gems that I found in the book
Thanks
was
very much.
It's packed full of great stories, as I said, but there's a Lieutenant Commander Hale who has an encounter with a harbour pilot in Hamburg. Can you just recount that story?
Commander Hale, Tim Hale, was captain of HMS Tiptoe, which was one of these Super T rebuilt submarines that was still in service in the late 60s. And this was March 1966 when, like many sailors, the idea of a visit to Hamburg when it was the swinging 60s for a run ashore as a break from exercises was very enticing. So the thing was, they had to get past Cuxhaven, up the River Elbe, and then come in alongside Hamburg, which was by no means easy. And by the time Tiptoe arrived, she was told that she'd have to wait at anchor in the river, which had quite a strong current, and wait for the morning to come in. So they did that. And Tiptoe, unfortunately, started to drag her anchor. So there was a bit of an emergency with the submarine being swept down the river. So they got that under control and throughout the night managed to hold on. And then in the morning, the following day, they went in to go into harbour. And that proved a little bit challenging. And coming into the berth was not easy in the current. And so a harbour pilot had been put aboard and he was there on the bridge of Tiptoe watching Tim cope with this very tricky process of bringing the submarine in. With a little smile on his face and watching as Tim basically gave some rather strident orders to people to sort themselves out. And then afterwards, Tim said, do you want to come down and have a scotch with me? And thanks for your help, because obviously he'd been advising him. And so Tim says, why were you smiling when we couldn't come in the first time? And this harbour pilot said, well, I haven't heard bad language like that since World War II. And it was then that Tim discovered that this guy was a former U-boat captain who'd been through the same process and done quite a bit of swearing when he couldn't get the boat in during the Second World War. So the two submarine captains had a whiskey and Tail saluted him and he saluted Tim. And that was how the sort of 20 years on, that was how the two sides kind of, you could say, buried the hatchet. And it's just a great little story because Tim's dad served in the Second World War. So he was the son of a veteran of that war. So there were, you know, in the Cold War, there was no problem with anybody from that era, especially if they were a submarine captain who'd survived at sea. So they got on as friends and had a whiskey.
It is a great story. And I've got in my mind's eye this grizzled U-boat captain with a battered hat on the bridge of the submarine. You know, it's just got that image, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, problems with bringing submarines into tricky harbours, etc., are going to be the same no matter which navy you're in. So I suppose that's why it made him laugh. So it was, you know, it's a nice little story, or as they say in the Navy, a good little dit.
That's great. Now, one of the things that did surprise me was how close the Soviets were getting to NATO exercises and bases. And I think there were a couple of incidents in 1966 and 67. Particularly.
Yeah, I mean, I think across the course of the Cold War, things happened that would surprise many people, where submarines, whether it was a British submarine up in the north going in off the Kola Peninsula or with Russian submarines or surface vessels, in fact, spy ships, coming in very close to the UK shores. And the incidents you're on about, well, the first one in 1966 was a Romeo class diesel that was trying to get in as close as possible, and it's reckoned went within UK territorial waters to basically snoop on what the Americans were doing with their ballistic missile submarines going in and out of the Holy Loch submarine base, the Polaris boats, but also trying to find what the Royal Navy's first nuclear-powered submarine, HMS Dreadnought, was up to, and whether or not she was armed with a new kind of nuclear missile and find out what kind of sound she made to try and identify if there was a future war. So this Romeo-class diesel boat comes in and has a snoop round and basically gets caught, is heard on SOSUS, and also then British warships, surface warships, and Shackleton maritime patrol aircraft are vectored in on this unfortunate Romeo, chase the submarine out from the Clyde into the open sea, and then pursue her and make her surface, very humiliating, and escort her well out of UK waters. So there's things like that happened more than once. And then I think the other one you're on about is 1967, when it was Kosygin was visiting the UK to talk with Harold Wilson about peace efforts in Vietnam. And at the same time as he was touching down to have these talks of peace, there was a whiskey class Russian submarine that left the Baltic to come and spy on whatever the British were doing as an exercise, or who knows, try and just keep tabs on what was happening ashore during the visit, and was detected. And three British frigates, a couple of diesel submarines and dreadnought, broke off from their exercise and were ordered to close the submarine for the purpose of hunting. And so as they're pursuing this whiskey class submarine, the British forces, told by Dennis Healy, who I think was the defence minister at the time, to maybe be a bit careful because they wouldn't want an incident to happen when the Russian prime minister is also ashore, and it could cause a bit of a ruckus. So they were told to back off. But it's the kind of thing that was, I would say, totally routine, but it went on frequently where navies that were in reality, certainly if they were submarines, were well armed and ready to go, but had to pull their punches and be careful because any mistake at sea could lead to either a collision or an exchange of fire or something like that. So it did go on out there where we didn't know it was going on as well.
Yeah, indeed. And what options would have been considered in order to force a Soviet submarine to surface in those circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, with a diesel electric submarine like a Whiskey or a Romeo, the main weapon, I would say, is to keep the boat down for hours and hours, maybe days, until the submarine runs out of air and is forced to surface to get some air and recharge the batteries. And at that point, there's a victory notched up for whichever side has done the forcing. So occasionally, you might see, for example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, low-powered depth charges were used to force submarines up off Cuba. And also the underwater telephone was used by the American surface warships off Cuba to advise the Russian submarines to surface. So you've got those options. And then the Russians up in the north, they would use depth charges, maybe low power, maybe not. One of the boats up there, which is in the book, was quite badly damaged. So they might even fire a torpedo wide to scare the submarine away. And again, you know, with a diesel electric submarine, if it was British in the north, it could be forced to stay down and then surface. So I think there was never an intention on either side to go all out and just kill whatever the intruding submarine was, because a lot of the time they were in international waters anyway. It just so happened they were spying on an exercise. And if they could keep them at arm's length and just keep an eye on them, they would. So I don't think anybody involved in what is quite a risky game would want to go too far. I think everybody was well aware of that because, of course, the nuclear weapons dimension and the nuclear-powered submarine dimension as time went on was always there. So you had to be very, very careful.
Yeah. It's incredible when you talk about, you know, the Soviets possibly firing a torpedo wide. I mean, you have to be really sure where the other submarine is to do something like that.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a fix, you know what the bearing is of the other submarine. A torpedo fired down another bearing, which makes a noise, which the opponent hears on the passive sonar, and that kind of warns them that they are actually, you know, they're getting too close, or they're intruding in an area where they shouldn't be. So it probably happened more often than you think. And the Russians had a famous tactic, and I don't want to preempt your Hunt for Red October thing. Maybe we could talk about it then. But they had, of course, the Crazy Ivan, which really was a real tactic. Yeah.
Okay. So as we move into the 1960s, the Royal Navy, as you said, decided that they needed to go nuclear with their submarines. And there's two types introduced, the SSN and the SSBN, and we will be testing listeners on this later. But Ian, if you can tell us their different roles and what the difference was from the diesel boats.
The SSN is a nuclear-powered...
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Fleet submarine, in Royal Navy parlance, in the sort of 60s and 70s, also known as a hunter-killer by the Americans, or an attack boat. So basically, its job is to attack other submarines or surface warships with conventional weaponry. And nowadays, such a boat would also have cruise missiles with conventional warheads. The SSBN is a ballistic missile submarine that carries 12, 16 on average, or did 16 on average during the Cold War, 16 missiles. And that could be for Britain, Polaris submarine. For the Americans, it would be the George Washington class, later the Ohio class. And for the Russians, initially, their first proper SSBN was the Yankee class. So the SSBNs have a whole section in them where they have ballistic missiles, which rely on satellites for targeting and are fired up into outer space and then plunge onto the target, causing world-ending destruction, whereas your SSN is there for hunting and killing other submarine surface vessels and is a tactical weapon, strategic effect, but basically for non-nuclear warfare and to possibly, if things turn nasty during the Cold War, to trail and destroy enemy SSBN. So it's a kind of, it's two distinct roles. And the SSBN, its primary task is to deploy and then stay hidden, stay quiet, stay out of the way. It's at a walking pace, literally. Disappear for several weeks, stay hidden under the sea, hope not to be detected, and just wait for that doomsday order, which obviously everybody hopes will never come, and stay out of the way. So it's not hunting for anybody, it's not looking for anybody. And it stays out of the way of SSNs if it hears them, and it probably would hear them, and basically hopes not to be found, whereas your SSN's out there hunting and sniffing around, trying to find other submarines and carrying out surveillance and espionage missions.
That's a perfect explanation. Thank you very much for that. Now, as you've sort of alluded to there, some of the SSNs were, I think they were called special fit boats. Can you just describe what they were intended to do, what their role was?
Yeah, special fit boats were a few nuclear powered submarines in the Royal Navy that were given intelligence gathering equipment and also extra people, communications technicians and others to assist them in carrying out the espionage mission up in the Barents Sea or sniffing around the edges of the White Sea during the Cold War. And so that included acoustic intelligence equipment, communications, signals intelligence, and electronic intelligence equipment, all packed into the submarine along with these extra people that would run it and assist with it. And so there was probably only, certainly in the early days, two or three at a time were available for that mission. And they would be tasked with the American submarines that were also their version of special fit with going up into the Barents. And then they would kind of run a relay where the British would go in and spy on weapons tests and sniff around and look at things and try and record things or photograph things or shoot video in the later part. And then the Americans would come in and the British would come out. So the story of HMS Warspite is one such special fit submarine, which features a fair bit in the book. So that's one I look at. But there were others. There was HMS Courageous and, of course, other boats as well. So that's a special fit boat. It does that kind of mission.
Right. So they're getting really close in to the Soviet forces to pick up this data.
Yeah. I think the thing about a nuclear-powered submarine is that you can hang a lot of high-power equipment on, which is really why the Royal Navy and the other navies went nuclear, was to basically, because you want to hide your submarine, particularly in the era of satellites, where, you know, people can look down and find them, or you just want to stay hidden under the sea all the time, or you need nuclear power that doesn't need air to keep going, that can generate air for the crew and doesn't need to suck in air to recharge a battery and get rid of fumes. That's nuclear power's obvious attraction, that you can go on under the ice, or you can go off around the world without having to surface at all. But it also means that with nuclear power, you can operate high-tech intelligence gathering equipment, sensors, and also weaponry. And it gives you all the power you need to do that. So that is the thing about a nuclear-powered submarine. And the special fit boats were the successors in the Royal Navy to the adapted diesel boats called the Super Ts. But they were of a different order, you know, completely to any diesel boat.
Right. And Warspite, who you mentioned just a moment ago, in 1968, it has an incident which is officially described as some trouble with some icebergs.
It's a standard thing, yeah, icebergs, yeah.
Can you just take us through what happened there?
Yeah, that's one of these icebergs that sort of is black and moves through the water and has a red star on it. But to this day, that incident is still officially described as a collision with an iceberg, and that caused quite a fair amount of damage and was very tricky. But the thing about Warspite and her story in the book is that I was able to present for the first time the inside view of that from Tim Hale, who was the XO of the submarine at the time, second in command, and also one or two other people who I picked up their accounts, and a guy called John Colling, who was in charge of the sonar, the sonar room at the time. So I was able to put together the first inside story of this quite famous iceberg collision, which, of course, everybody really that has any insight into it knows was a Russian submarine that they unfortunately had a coming together with in the Barents Sea. And in this case, it was an Echo 2 nuclear-powered submarine armed with missiles, not a ballistic missile submarine, but a missile firing submarine that could fire nuclear tipped weapons, and was basically sailing through the Barents Sea, and Warspite was trailing her and trying to pick up and record the sound signature of the boat and gather any intelligence possible. And it was actually Warspite's first trail. And what happened was the Echo 2 has two screws, and they shut one of them down. And this meant that Warspite suspected initially that the submarine was turning, but in fact she just shut, I think, if memory serves me correct, her starboard screw, and was still going the same way. So as Warspite came round thinking she was about to turn to follow this submarine, she was underneath her, and she came in contact with her and was rolled right over. And to quite a serious degree. And one guy in the book describes how he was in his mess aboard and ended up kind of walking on the ceiling of the mess to keep himself steady as the boat rolled over. And they knew pretty quickly that something serious had gone wrong. They could hear the sound. The fortunate thing was that in the manoeuvring room, which is the compartment in the back end that contains the controls of the nuclear reactor, the engineer officer, a guy called Frank Turvey, instantly knew what had happened, and he decided that he would counteract this automatic safety measure designed to prevent a nuclear accident, which might seem a bit odd, but in that extreme situation, he decided that he had to make sure that the reactor was not shut down when the boat rolled, because that it was a kind of automatic shut off when Warspite rolled over, having hit the Echo 2. So Turvey makes sure that the reactor power isn't lost, which means that when Tim Hale and also the boss, Commander Harvey, in the control room, decide that what they've got to do is get the submarine on the surface, they have the power to do that, and they can maintain all power, and the submarine didn't go crashing to the floor of the Barents Sea. So they retained control of the submarine and got the submarine on the surface after the collision with the Echo 2. And then there was this kind of very tense moment where the damaged Warspite and the slightly damaged Echo 2 were both on the surface looking at each other, inspecting each other through periscopes and wondering what was next. And it turned out in that instance that they just kind of looked at each other, and then each one, the Echo 2, moved off, and then Warspite was faced with assessing the damage that had been suffered during the collision. So what they had to do was go out and look at the fin, the tower bit, and they found that was quite badly stoved in, so they had to make sure everything was watertight, and then limp back to get back to Scotland, basically. And so it was a very, very tricky moment, but thankfully there were cool heads and they both sort of parted company, and the Echo 2 went back to Murmansk or wherever, and they headed back to Scotland. But they did it dived. They got down once they checked that the boat was watertight and took Warspite away and out of the area and then back home. So it was a very tricky moment. It's all in the book, and it was a key moment for me, was to meet people that had been there, because I thought, well, this is a really exciting story that I've got to get in there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there is plenty of drama in the book. Would the Soviet submarine been able to identify Warspite as a British submarine then?
I'm not going to say 100% that she would have. She would have obviously known that this was a NATO boat. They might have done. It depends. When she was an early Valiant class submarine, so they might have known the shape, and they would have, who knows, they might have taken a photograph. I don't know. I mean, probably they would know, American or British, so they would have known. They wouldn't have thought it was one of their own. So whoever the captain was of the Echo 2 was a pretty cool customer as well, I would say.
Yeah, a Marco Ramius, huh?
A Marco Ramius, maybe not. Maybe he's not from the Baltic states, but anyway, whoever he was, we could be grateful that he didn't lose his nerve, as it were, or just get very angry.
Yeah, yeah.
Same goes for, you know, Commander Harvey, who was the boss of HMS Warspite. So, I mean, he was commendably cool, and everybody on board, in fact, you know, the people that saved the boat, basically Tim made sure that she surfaced immediately because he was the XO, he took action, and in the maneuvering room, that guy also made sure that they kept power. So it was very lucky, very lucky. But of course, it was an iceberg, so, you know,
exactly.
It never really happened. Yeah,
exactly. Probably lost their no claims bonus after that one. But
it's tricky icebergs. Yeah.
Just going back to the SSBNs, can you just give us a little bit more detail about how they operated?
Yeah, the structure of the book is to take the reader through the Cold War from the late 40s to the end of the Cold War. So I have four main submarine captains, a few other guys, including ratings and mentors for junior officers as well. But Rob Forsyth was one of the key players, as well as Tim Hale. And then we've got another submarine legend called Doug Littlejohns, and we have Dan Connolly as well. So those four guys are the main players, so they kind of take you through the whole story. But Rob Forsyth served as the XO of a Polaris missile submarine in the early 70s. And he, along with his captain at the time, they both knew where the submarine was, but the majority of people in the boat, other than them, wouldn't know at the time, because it just really wasn't their job to know, because they had to focus on just running the boat and getting on with their lives under the sea for several weeks. So Rob gives a good account of how those submarines worked. And if you want, and there is a ratings version of it, of the story of what it felt like. That's from a guy called Michael Pitt-Keithley, which is very interesting to read. But the in general, they would go out from Faz Lane, and then, as I mentioned before, they would spend most of their time just trying to lead a very quiet life and stay out of the way. And they would run a routine, and they would know, due to the lighting system, when it was a certain time of the day or what meal they were having. And they would pursue all sorts of activities to keep themselves interested, like making models or studying for degrees or other qualifications. But on the whole, the people that knew what was going on and would have to keep tabs on things was the XO and the captain. One of the stories that Rob tells is that they would occasionally come up and poke the aerial up and get the World Service. And if they could hear the BBC World Service was on and everything was normal, they would know that there hadn't been some kind of nuclear Armageddon, that everything was correct. So if there was ever a moment of doubt, they would tune in to whatever the radio broadcast was. And so long as they found the BBC World Service or Radio 4 or something, then they knew that all was well. So that was one of the things they used to do.
Right. Right. And the one area, well, there's many areas that fascinate me, but we'd be here all day. But
yeah,
the one that interests me is the letter that the UK Prime Minister writes to every commander of Britain's nuclear deterrent, and that's known as the Letter of Last Resort.
Yeah, yeah, it still exists to this day, and every prime minister, when they assume office, is taken, I presume they are taken into a side room, sat down and at number 10 and told to write this letter of last resort, and that's then distributed. In fact, there's four of them, because there's four ballistic missile submarines, and each submarine gets this letter that is stuck in a safe. So the reason they do that is that if the prime minister is wiped out with the rest of the leadership, the political leadership, this letter, which says what his or her desire would be in a nuclear confrontation where missiles may or may not need to be fired, is written down on this letter and kept in this safe. And it conveys the prime minister's wishes. And then if there's no command authority coming down from the politicians, it's opened and read by the captain of the submarine and the XO. But, of course, nobody's ever seen that letter in all the time since the first Polaris submarine patrols by the Royal Navy in the late 60s until today, when the letter of last resort is currently in the hand of Boris Johnson. In terms of writing, his handwriting, that letter from Boris Johnson and before him, Theresa May, is in the safe of the Vanguard class missile submarines that we have at sea at the moment. But in the Cold War, it was obviously people like Jim Callaghan, obviously Margaret Thatcher, of course Tony Blair later on, and all those people. So it's kept in the safe, and at that particular moment where nobody knows what to do, they open it up and they read it. And Rob in Hunter Killers, Rob Forsyth, speculates that there are alternatives written down, possibly, you know, that maybe the Prime Minister has written hit back with your missiles because we've been nuked, or don't hit back, or there might be some other instruction. But neither Rob, who served as the XO of a Polaris submarine, or anybody else really knows what's in those letters. So let's hope that we never have to have them, because we won't know either.
No, we won't.
It never opened. That's all I've got to say. Yeah, I would like to write it. Would you like to write that? I wouldn't.
No. I mean, but that must be one of the biggest impacts when you become Prime Minister, of the responsibility that you have.
Yeah, I would say, I would probably think it's incredibly sobering to, you're there and you're sort of being slapped on the back, or, you know, hands being shaken by all these people, and you've ascended to become Prime Minister, and then somebody says, excuse me, could you just come into this side room, please? You've got to write this letter and decide whether or not you want us, if we've been nuked, do you want us to nuke them, or do you just want us to say, I will not nuke back, you know, I won't fire the missiles back. That must be incredibly, you know, foreboding. The idea that you've actually got to write down what to do is just beyond anything I think we'd like to do, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, so if the worst happens and they have to launch, what is the process for the authentication and launch of the missiles?
If an order to fire has been issued, there's a thing called a national fire control message transmitted to what is the patrolling SSBN, because there's one, the whole system is meant to guarantee, and this is why you have four, that there'll be one at sea all the time throughout the year. And, you know, from 1968 until today, in terms of the Royal Navy, there's always been this, what they call the continuous at-sea deterrent. So there'll always be a boat. Submarines are called boats, no matter how big they are. There's a submarine out there carrying nuclear missiles. So what you get is you get the National Fire Control message transmitted to the SSBM. The coordinates for whatever the targets are loaded or into the missiles. And then the NCM contains two sets of authentication codes. And you've got one for the CO, one for the XO. And they have to match what's held aboard the submarine. And then to make sure that no one person can do it, there's a further safeguard. And the codes are kept, the codes that they have aboard the submarine are kept in two separate safes. And the respective combinations are only known to the XO and the CO separately. And then after that, according to what I've been told, and this is in the book, so I'll probably refer closely to that, you get step one, this is the most important step, which is the authentication of the firing signal by the XO and CO. So that brings the two separate codes together to achieve what I was told is called unique authentication. And then permission to fire is given by turning the captain's key, which is found in one of these safes in the control room panel. And then completion of the firing circuit is done by the weapons engineer officer, who was also at the time the Polaris systems officer, via a pistol grip and trigger attached to a wire, which is connected to a control panel in a missile. So those three stages are next after they realize they've got to launch. And then there's a whole system that takes over and goes through a load of other actions. And then the moment of firing comes when the submarine rises to launch depth. And then once the pressure inside the tubes has been equalized with the pressure outside, the lids open and the missile or missiles are rejected, and then they are then launched. They then launch themselves off into the sky and go away towards their target. So the missile breaks the surface, the first stage ignition kicks in, the rocket motors fire, and it goes away into the sky. And that's it. But I have to say, you know, that process and other aspects of it are there to make sure you cannot just accidentally launch a nuclear missile. When I visited HMS Vengeance, which is a modern Trident missile submarine in Faz Lane, you know, I walked down between the missile tubes, and then we went into the office where they would launch the missiles from. I was explained to me that the there's a whole process to make sure that the missiles aren't armed, ready to go all the time, and that there's 60 steps before they can actually fire them. So there's all sorts of fail safes there, but it's very complicated, as you can hear, and I hope I've made it reasonably simple to understand, but in the book it might be easier to understand if you read it.
There's a video I found of YouTube which I think shows the procedure on a Polaris boat, which I will add to the show notes for this episode. That's worth watching, because that does show that this pistol grip as well, and
is a real one.
It's bizarre, isn't it?
When Rob was talking to me about lots of different issues and connected to the deterrent at the time during the Cold War, he mentioned that one of the things they also have is, in case somebody loses their mind at some stage or lost their mind at some stage during a Cold War patrol, they had a baseball bat, which they would use to basically, somebody goes mad and starts to interfere with the launch equipment, then they can take them out with a baseball bat, because you wouldn't want to use a gun in there. So that's the irony of it. You've got a pistol grip attached to a wire if that Armageddon day ever comes. But actually, if somebody goes a bit mad, then they did have, in Repulse, a baseball bat to subdue them. So they've got to think of everything, I think.
Yeah, so, very contingency. Very sobering.
Yeah, it is very sobering. And yeah. Rob and the others were under no illusions about the heavy weight of responsibility that they had. And, you know, opinions change. I know he's got his doubts these days whether we should still have Trident, and he's quite clear about that. He's not sure that it's relevant today, but he does think that in the Cold War, there was a purpose for it, and it was to try and institute, you know, mutually assured destruction, MAD, to ensure that we didn't have a nuclear war. And that's the weird thing about nuclear weapons, is that they're actually political weapons, as Doug Littlejohn's explained to me about massive Russian nuclear submarines with missiles and big American nuclear missile submarines. They're not weapons of war to be used. They're actually political weapons to stop war. But they can only be effective if you go about it meaning to use them. And it's a kind of paradox that sort of does your head in, that we have these immensely powerful submarines with these terrible weapons on board, which could end humanity and the planet. But in fact, they're there to try and stop anybody doing that. Whether or not that equation still works is a different matter. But certainly during the Cold War, it seemed to be a system that, although it had its moments, worked. And we didn't have that Armageddon, thank goodness.
Yeah, yeah. No, there is an argument that, you know, nuclear weapons were the biggest factor in maintaining the peace during the Cold War.
Yeah. I mean, there were tens of millions of people died in the Second World War, and without some kind of deterrent on each side during that period to make people think, it could well have been that we would have seen a Third World War. But, of course, at the same time, I mean, I'm a child of the Cold War. We were all living on the edge of a precipice, you know, of destruction, and we all felt that as well. Mm. So it was a weird kind of feeling to be a child of the Cold War, to think that you lived with that ever-present threat. And it's a threat that hasn't actually got away, but I don't think we think of it the same way. But fortunately, the people that were at the top realised that, and, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis is an example of that. And when it came to that moment where one side or the other had to blink, or there was one person in the system that could stop nuclear war from happening, then it happened. And we were very, very lucky, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very sobering thought.
It is. It is. There's another iceberg incident in 1981. What happens there?
Yeah, that would be an iceberg that was really, in reality, a Delta III ballistic missile boat. And this was being trailed by HMS Scepter, which was a Swiftsure-class submarine. And basically what happened was they came together, and Scepter sustained an enormous amount of damage, but did not obviously sink, because she went on to serve for a number of years. But it was another tricky moment, and they were lucky that there was nothing more serious. But there were questions asked in the House of Commons a few years later. But she had to go into a dry dock at Devonport, and Doug Littlejohn's, one of the main players in the book, was sent down to take a look at her and take command, and then take her back out to sea and get everybody ready for operations again, which was quite a challenge. So Scepter's forward casing had been torn away, which was quite a terrifying amount of damage. And she was coming up from a deeper depth than the Delta III, and then it's reckoned might have been turning across the Russian submarine's stern, and was pushed down violently by the collision, and one of the five-bladed screws of the Delta III ballistic missile submarine chewed along HMS Scepter and then raked the fin. So it's not something that's totally secret. There's been one or two people who were aboard have mentioned it, and can't say anybody that I spoke to gave me every spit and cough, but I sort of was able to glean enough from my own inquiries and various things to realise it wasn't an iceberg. It was a submarine, a Russian submarine. So it was, that was in the early 80s. So things started to hot up again in the early 80s. The competition at sea got more and more intense. So I think it was just a sign of how there were more and more submarines out there, and they were in close proximity. So things like that can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Because by the mid 1980s, the Soviet Navy's making some quite big leaps in terms of their technology, with particularly with the Akula class. How were they achieving these technological leaps?
One way of achieving them, which I know you're well aware of was, of course, the John Walker spy ring, which managed to hoover up all sorts of technological intelligence and also operational intelligence and pass it on to the Russians. That was a major part of it. But the Russians also tried to acquire technology in the open market, you know, how to refine the screws or, you know, reduce the noise being given off. So they basically hoovered up what they could in terms of secrets gained by spies inside the US Navy or anywhere else, and also buy in, like, say, milling equipment to refine the screws that propelled the submarines. And the Akula was a representation, more so than the much vaunted Alpha. The Akula was a representation of how the Russians had, by the early to mid 80s, were catching up, were closing the gap in terms of technology and quality of submarine build as well. And so that's a submarine that is still serving in the Russian Navy, just in a slightly updated version.
Right, right. And so did the Walker spy ring let them know that there was noise coming from there?
Yeah, I mean, he was spying for them for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And I suppose what he would have passed on to them, amongst many things, was just the knowledge that they had boats at certain times and places and days picked up by the Americans or SOSUS or something. Or I'm not sure that you might know this better than me. I'm not sure that he or other members of his spy ring knew about SOSUS or the deep secrets. But certainly he would, I mean, it's like many things. If you give somebody a certain amount of information and they've got information coming from somewhere else, open source stuff, then you can put it all together and the jigsaw sort of comes together. So I think he was able to tell them that they needed to up their game, basically, and would have passed on to them, if he could get his hands on it, anything that was useful to them in terms of improving their technology.
Yeah, because I think it's reckoned that that spy ring did a massive amount of damage in terms of providing the Soviets with information. Definitely worth an episode, I think. I'll have to find somebody who can...
You find somebody that's really... I've obviously got stuff on that in there because it was an essential part of the story. It's got to be, you know, how did people... who were traitors within the Royal Navy set up the UK or in the anywhere else, you know, in the US Navy or any other part of Western society, help them by passing on secrets. And he was, without doubt, probably the worst breach. Yeah.
And as you said, I mean, you said in the mid-1980s, it's getting more intense out there. And there's another dangerous incident with HMS Splendid, which collides with a typhoon, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that was by the late 80s. So I think there was an awareness by then, which is fascinating to read Hansard at the time. There was certainly an awareness by then that with the technological gap closing, with the Russian Navy's submarine force expanding, with the Royal Navy, you know, being a reasonable level, and the Americans expanding, and these Typhoon class ballistic missile submarines out there, and the Americans and all the rest of it, the North Atlantic was getting to be a fairly crowded place comparatively. So the Royal Navy submarines, Splendid as a Swiftsure class submarine, was sent up there on these special missions whenever needed. And in her case, she was in the Barents Sea, and using a thing called a towed array, which is something I once called in an article I wrote, an electronic sausage, which is like a sonar in a sort of sausage skin, a load of microphones that you put on the end of a very long, very, very long cable, and you tow it a long way behind the submarine because you want to get it removed from your own noise, and it's a passive sonar, so it listens. And so then you can hear what's going on out there, but it essentially lengthens the submarine by quite a lot. So it's a massive, if you include the towed array on the end of its wire, this is a submarine that's got a very long length, the physical submarine and the towed array. So they were using a Tota Ray in the Barents Sea, and somehow the Tota Ray got ripped off and wrapped around this Russian submarine. So the Russians, as I said in the book, that's a neat little intelligence gift to the Kremlin, so they could the Russians now had something to study. But, you know, it's the sort of thing that happens. But it did at the time, with, you know, Ronald Reagan building up the US Navy and the arms race gathering pace again towards the end of the Cold War. It did arouse concerns in Parliament about the Royal Navy's submariners and submarines being pushed too far, and everything getting a bit too intense. So it's quite a famous incident, you know, in the late 80s, and there were questions asked in Parliament about it. Yeah.
Now, I think one of the things I like about the book is you do follow the careers of various characters in there as they move from boat to boat. And one thing I hadn't realised is that the submarine commanders transferred to surface ships, so you've effectively got poacher turned gamekeeper. And there's a really nice piece in there about HMS London and a Soviet exercise in the Baltic.
The idea that poacher turned gamekeeper is not new. I mean, during the Second World War, there were plenty of ex-submariners in command of escort ships that would attack the U-boats, hunt them down. And it's a policy that goes on to this day. So in that case, HMS London was a what they call a batch 2 Type 22 frigate built in the mid-80s. And her job, she was in essence packed full of intelligence gathering equipment, had missiles and torpedoes and a helicopter, but had this ability to gather intelligence. And under the command of Doug Littlejohns, who had been captain of a diesel boat, and then HMS Scepter has served as second command of other submarines and worked in the MOD, coordinating submarine operations. He was basically given command of HMS London, and he took her into the Baltic, which is a very confined area of sea comparatively. And so he rigged HMS London as a merchant vessel and went in at night, and then kind of appeared off the coast of what was then part of the Soviet Union, the Baltic States, and monitored what the Russians were up to. But part of that whole episode was that they found a Russian diesel submarine and basically did what I mentioned earlier, kept the Russian diesel submarine down until the sub was forced up. And then Doug flashed a cheeky message saying, "How are you doing? You know, good morning." But also part of that, they liked to have fun with the Russians that were shadowing them. So they would they had a competition, sort of, to build the biggest looking missile, fake missile that had ever been created on board HMS London. And the Russians thought they'd found this new terror missile. And Doug was in charge. And of course, he showed what could be done, you know, with the submarine captain at the helm. Because the thing about that incident where he found the Russian diesel and forced it to the surface in the Baltic was that, of course, as an ex-submarine captain, he had insight into what the submarine captain might do next. So he was able to keep on that diesel submarine's case and make life very uncomfortable. So, that's how it works, really. If you know how a submariner's going to think and you're in charge of an anti-submarine or an intelligence-gathering ship, like a Type 22 frigate like that one, then, of course, you can try and anticipate what they're going to do. So that's the whole idea. I mean, he wasn't the only one that was an ace submarine captain who then commanded a surface ship.
Yeah. I think what the other bit that I liked about this exercise is the burial at sea.
Oh, yeah. Again, he was having a bit of fun with the Russians. That was basically, if you can imagine at the time, I mean, I went to the Soviet Union at the end of the Cold War, and in fact, in HMS London, I went to the Barents, so I kind of got a taste of it. But Russia was starved of Western comforts, so Doug had by this stage become friendly with Tom Clancy, so he decided to have a bit of fun with the Russians. He decided that to tempt them with the luxuries of the West, what he would do is they would have a fake burial at sea. So they made a little coffin up, and they put inside this thing a bottle of whiskey, a Russian language copy of The Hunt for Red October, passed on by Tom Clancy to Doug, because Doug, you know, met Clancy shortly after he wrote The Hunt for Red October. And also, you know, not very PC, a copy of a girly magazine, and with a note from Doug saying, haven't you got anything better to do? And so they had this Doug, I think it was Doug, dressed up as the Padre, and they put this coffin into the Baltic, and this Russian Matka class boat was coming in to pick this up, picked it up. And so Doug had a laugh, you know, they had a laugh at the Russian expense, because there was there were the decadent, corrupt West's treasures and temptations in this coffin. So I bet they I wonder whether or not they reported any of that and just kept the whiskey and the copy of The Hunt for Red October. But anyway, it was good fun for the London's crew.
Yeah, it's a great story. And, yeah. And as I've said before, there are loads of these great stories in here. But we'd be on here for hours if we covered all of them. I'm interested to know what you think of the Hunt for Red October film.
I think it's one of the better ones. I think it's pretty good. I mean, it's I first saw it. I don't know when you first saw it. I saw it at the cinema when it was released the first time. And just trying to remember how we felt about it at the time. But it was, I think it's a really good movie. I think one of the things that impressed me, and I think impressed some mariners, was how well he depicted a lot of the tactics, and obviously within a fictional scenario of a typhoon defecting. But they were very impressed. And I know that Doug and other, James Perrown was another prominent British submarine captain at the time, were very impressed by Clancy's insights into what they did. And one of the things I wanted to do with the book was to look at the fictional scenarios, such as that trench run that Marco Ramius does in his massive submarine to escape the torpedo, and also the spying on other submarines, or the sort of cat and mouse games of those, and put their real life counterparts in. So, you know, I think a lot of the stuff that happened that Clancy portrayed, because he basically worked as I think an insurance salesman. People should read the book. I've got it down there. It's a few years since I wrote it, but he definitely went round the homes of lots of American submariners and sort of hoovered up all the various stories and then sort of stitched it together into this narrative. So I thought the book's a good read, and I think the movie's pretty good. And who can ever forget the Sean Connery's portrayal of a Scottish Soviet submarine captain? I mean, it's just brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is one of my favourite films, and I think it manages to capture a lot of what life was like during that period, as well as being a compelling and dramatic film. I think it managed to satisfy sort of as many people as possible with it. It's certainly where I first heard the term Crazy Ivan.
Yeah, the Crazy Ivan, as said earlier, that is a real tactic. In a submarine, you have that area behind the submarine where, because of your own propulsion noise, your sonar cannot hear if there's somebody following you. So the Russians came up with this idea of the Crazy Ivan, which is to suddenly turn around and then charge down that bearing to see if anybody's following you. And it might be that if you might hit them or collide with them. They were pretty aggressive using the Crazy Ivan. So, yeah, that tactic, in fact, used a lot more aggressively, is a real thing. So, I mean, that just proves how close he got with a lot of it. Yeah. I think Das Boot and The Hunt for Red October are two movies I would put up there as being a good watch, and also I think pretty close to reality for the professionals who I think quite like them as well.
Right. Well, that's a good recommendation. I'll provide links to both of those in the show notes. Now, as you alluded to just a moment ago, you were there for the very end of the Cold War on HMS London in the Barents Sea, and this was 1991. Can you tell us why you were there and what did you see?
At the time, I was the defence reporter of the Evening Herald newspaper in Plymouth, and we had based in Plymouth quite a lot of warships at that time. About two dozen frigates, and London was one of those. And as the the Cold War came to its end, John Major and Mikhail Gorbachev had this idea that for the first time in 50 years, a British warship should visit officially, because they've been up there a few times unofficially, and that includes HMS London, should visit the Barents Sea and then go down the Murmansk Inlet to Murmansk itself. And that was a defence, what they would call today, a defence diplomacy mission. And then after that, go around to Archangel. And that was a kind of reenactment of the convoys during World War II, when a previous HMS London, which was a cruiser, had gone on a similar diplomatic mission to set up the convoys from the Allies to the Russians during World War II, which started after Russia came in on our side. HMS London was sent as an ambassador to go up around the north of Norway and then go and visit Murmansk and Archangel. And then just as we were about to set sail, the hardliners' coup took place in Moscow with Gorbachev trapped in his summer holiday home, and nobody knew what was going on, and we thought the Cold War was coming back. But we went up to Rosyth and left aboard HMS London and then sailed up around the top, wondering, A, you know, what kind of reception would we get in the Barents Sea, and B, you know, was it still on, and is the Cold War about to resume? And so we proceeded. It was quite good weather. We proceeded round the top of Norway into the Barents Sea, and then wondered what was going to happen. And occasionally a Russian jet would fly over, and then a Sovremeny-class destroyer appeared on the horizon. And then it appeared the trip was on, and then this whole kind of flotilla of Russian warships and aircraft flying over, along with a hospital ship with a load of British and Russian veterans, was on board. And we realized then that this whole thing was going to happen. And so then we went down the inlet to Murmansk and saw basically the state of the Russian Navy, which was a state of collapse at that time. And with, you know, old hulks drawn up on the side of the inlet, and basically a lot of ships in port. And but they still sent out a fair few, because there were exercises off the coast, you know, in the Barents after the visit. And there was a Tango class submarine, a diesel submarine, which appeared just off HMS London. And these two guys were sent out onto the casing, and they assembled a saluting gun, which we were sort of watching with quite aghast at the sort of waves washing over the these two guys. They fired a salute on this little saluting gun, which sort of popped out of the casing, then put it away, and then climbed back in the submarine, and it went under the sea. And as legend has it, and at the time, I wrote about it, and sometimes you do wonder if this happened, they fired a torpedo at us as part of this World War II reenactment, and it was a practice torpedo. I mean, I don't want to over-exaggerate it. It was a sort of orange, wire-guided thing without a warhead in it, but it came at this quite high speed, and we weren't aware of it. And the captain of HMS London, Mark Stanhope, who was a first Sea Lord later and had been a captain of SSNs up in the Barents during the Cold War, was sort of quite astonished, as were other people, watching this thing come in. And it kind of, London had to make evasive action. So did this Royal Fleet Auxiliary tanker. So this wire-guided practice torpedo went by. And I just sort of had in my head, I had this image of the Russians who were controlling this sort of practice torpedo, which if it had hit London, which had a very thin skin, might have punched a hole in her, could well have done. I just imagine these Russians, you know, on the controls of this thing going, yes, now we get them. You know? So at the end, they think it's over, you know,
yeah.
We've got them. So it was an amazing time to go there. With the hardliners' coup collapsing, us going down there to Murmansk and then over to Archangel. It was just an amazing trip, you know, fantastic and full of incident.
It must have been incredible going into basically the lair of the Soviet Navy and seeing what it had come to over the years.
Yeah. I mean, there was I do remember there was I think it was called the. Actually called the Gorshkov at the time, was one of their helicopter stroke anti-submarine cruiser carriers that they had for their own short takeoff and vertical landing aircraft, flashing a signal in the sort of grimy mist and of welcome as we went down past Severomorsk. And there was a Helix helicopter, a Russian Navy Helix helicopter, circling London as she kind of processed down. And they were definitely sort of taking photos of the London to see what sensor she had and what she looked like. And I know there was a Royal Navy photographer because I stood beside him and saw him at work with a landscape camera, sort of taking photos of the state of the Russian fleet and, in fact, the whole inlet. So even then, there was although there was a newfound amity and there was plenty of vodka drunk and toasts made to the end of the Cold War, there was certainly still an edge to keeping tabs.
Yeah, I found that really powerful, that scene that you paint there right at the end of the Cold War. And I think, you know, what your book tells us is that obviously there was the confrontation in Central Europe, but that the most dangerous sort of area of confrontation was in reality under the sea.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to ask you is whether there's any efforts being made to better honour the sacrifice of submariners in the UK.
Yeah, I think that aspect can be forgotten, that people do focus on the mass tank formations in Central Europe. And it was a very, you know, tense and also quite a dangerous theatre, I suppose. But I think this... The silent war, the cat and mouse game at sea that went on for decades was probably the most dangerous, because those guys, whether they were Russian, American or British, were all in close company with submarines armed with warshot torpedoes or nuclear missiles and nuclear pad as well. And certainly in terms of the Royal Navy, I think it is overlooked that for many years, the submariners would basically cut themselves off from their families, sacrifice their family life, and go off in these boats and go up into the Barents Sea or out deep into the Atlantic and basically keep tabs on what the other side was doing and keeping the deterrent safe, but also ensuring that we knew what the Russians were doing so that that Cold War never turned hot. And there's in terms of submarine warfare history across the piece, the Cold War, I think, can be neglected sometimes. You know, it doesn't have its own museum. And there is actually an effort underway at the moment, a proposal to use HMS Courageous, which was one of these submarines that went and did this dangerous work, as a key part of a broader Cold War Royal Navy museum that will also look at the surface part as well as the submarines and the maritime patrol aircraft as well, and other elements, you know, the Royal Marines, for example, in Norway and the northern flank. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff to look at, and that is a proposal that's just been looked into. It's only a feasibility study at the moment to have a Royal Navy Cold War Museum in Devonport, which is the naval base and dockyard, a huge naval base and dockyard in Plymouth. And there's also another effort underway at the National Arboretum to create a submariner's memorial there too. So there's two efforts underway, and that submariner's memorial there is a project, a big project that's underway also. I think those two efforts will pay tribute to, you know, the submarine service and the sacrifice and sometimes, you know, the lives lost and the immense effort that they've conducted in war and peace, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I would like to try and support that as much as possible, because I think it is important that this part of the Cold War is remembered properly. Yeah, absolutely. You've been listening to Ian Ballantyne, the author of Hunter Killers or Undersea Warriors, as it's published in the US. There will be links in the show notes to purchase the book. If you use those links, you will be helping to support the podcast too. And we have further photos, videos and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, this podcast would not exist without our generous Patreons. And I would like to especially thank our Politburo level members who contribute a generous $30 a month each to help keep us on the air. They are Tony Sowards, Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, Jeffrey Jones, Matthew Comstock, Frederick Esposito, and Peter Ryan. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.